You know his dates. He died in 1616. He was born in 1564. I remember that his birth year well because I was teaching that year in high school. 1964, not 54. And there were probably about half dozen students who weren't in class. That was unusual. And class began, and here they came. They had a birthday cake.
Oh.
In 1964, they had a birthday cake for his 400th birthday.
Oh.
And they had 400 candles on them. Needless to say, we ate wax more. And they lit them in the hall and brought the thing in. They had spent much of the night driving around Minneapolis and St. Paul to find enough of those little, tiny little candles. One of them finally went over to St. Paul to find a place that was open to get enough. And somebody burned their fingers, but I remember it well. From fairest creatures we desire increase, that thereby beauties, that should be beauties, not berries, that thereby beauty's rose might never die, but as the riper should by time decrease, his tender air might bear his memory. But thou, contracted through thine own bright eyes, feed'st thy light's flame with self-substantial fuel, making a famine where abundance lies, thyself thy foe, to thy sweet self too cruel. Thou art now the world's fresh ornament, and only herald to the gaudy spring. Within thine own bud bearest thy content, and, tender churl, makest waste in niggarding. Pity the world, or else this glutton be, to eat the world's dew by the grave and thee. Okay? Decide what is the argument there? By argument I mean in the rhetorical sense. What is the persuasion, that Shakespeare is laying down, that he is trying to urge his listener to heed? Number two, when 40 winters shall besiege thy brow, and dig deep trenches in thy beauty's field, and youth's proud livery so gazed on now will be a tattered weed of small worth held, then being asked where all thy beauty lies, or all the treasure of thy lusty days, to say within thine own deep sunken eyes were an ill-eating shame and thriftless praise. How much more praise deserved thy beauty's use if thou couldst answer, this fair child of mine shall sum my count and make my own excuse, proving his beauty by succession thine. This were to be new made when thou art old, and see thy blood warm when thou feel'st it cold. What do those two have in common, the argument? Let's see, number three here. Part of that is missing. We'll go to number five. Those hours that with gentle work did frame the lovely gaze where every eye doth dwell will play the tyrants to the very same, and that unfair which fairly doth excel. For never-resting time leads summer on to hideous winter and confounds him there. Sap checked with frost and lusty leaves quite gone, beauty o'ersnowed and bareness everywhere. Then, were not summer's distillation left, a liquid prisoner pent in walls of glass, beauty's effect with beauty were bereft, nor it, nor no remembrance what it was. But flowers distilled, though they with winter meet, least but their show, their substance still lives sweet. Least is an archaic form of lose. Anybody want to suggest what is the argument?
Passing time.
Try that again?
Passing time.
Passing time. That would
spring
be a,
to winter.
What is the argument regarding passing time? What is the data?
Changes that come with it.
Just a minute, I did too.
Sounds to me like he's saying it's important to have a child to carry on his line or something. In the first two, I don't know, he was talking about fine. The first two, he seemed to be talking about offspring.
Well, let's see. Number seven. Anybody else want to suggest something?
Aging, too.
I beg your pardon?
And aging is in here, too.
Okay. Lo, in the Orient, when the gracious light lifts up his burning head, each under eye doth homage to his new appearing sight, serving with looks his sacred majesty. And having climbed the steep up heavenly hill, resembling strong youth in his middle age, yet mortal looks adore his beauty still, attending on his golden pilgrimage. But when from highmost pitch, with weary car, like feeble age, he reeleth from the day, the eyes, for duteous, now converted are from his low track, and look another way. So thou, thyself outgoing in thy noon, unlooked on diest unless thou get us soon.
Get a sign here soon.
I beg your pardon?
Should it be sun or soon?
No, I'm just trying to rhyme with noon.
Oh. I still think he's saying you better have a kid so that you're in the school today. That's the impression I get.
I beg your pardon?
I still think he's getting to have a child so your image doesn't die out.
Well, let's see. Music to hear, why hear some music sadly? Sweets with sweets worn out, joy delights in joy. Why lovest thou that which thou receivest not gladly, or else receivest with the pleasure thine annoy? If the true concord of well-tuned sounds, by unions married, do offend thy ear, they do but sweetly chide thee, who confounds in singleness the parts that thou shouldst bear. Mark how one string, sweet husband to another, strikes each in each by mutual ordering, resembling sire and child and happy mother, who all in one pleasing note do sing. Whose speechless song, being many, seeming one, sings this to thee, thou single wilt prove none. You still hold with your...
Well, not so much in that one, because all of us... Well, there's the singleness again. Maybe he's talking about marriage, because he's talking about, you know, without... Or music, only one string isn't really a song. You have to have others, like the wife and child and all this.
There?
Yeah, that if he doesn't, he sees in himself that all he sees are these bad things, but that there's still so much budding within him, and that there's so much attractive in him to find whatever, a wife, to have a son and have an heir. I don't know.
Okay, number 12. When I do count the clock that tells the time, and see the brave day sunk in hideous night, when I behold the violet past prime, and sable curls all silvered o'er with white, when lofty trees I see barren of leaves, which erst from heat did canopy the herd, and summer's green all girded up in sheaves, borne on the bier with white and bristly beard, then of thy beauty do I question make, that thou among the wastes of time must go, since sweets and beauty do themselves forsake, and die as fast as they see others grow. And nothing against time's side can make defense, save greed, to brave him when he takes thee hence. Is the argument still the same?
It seems to be. Mm-hmm.
Number 15.
Does he use the winter as a metaphor for older age or something?
What?
Does he use the winter as being a metaphor for age?
I don't want to answer that. Is winter a metaphor for age in the poem?
Time is moving on
often. We're not going to do this all afternoon, so don't get up and leave yet. We're going to look at one of these, or maybe two, more closely in small groups. Some of you haven't been and don't know what our strategy is here. Number 15. When I consider everything that grows, holds in perfection but a little moment, that this little stage presenteth naught but shows, whereon the stars in secret influence comment, when I perceive that men as plants increase, cheered and checked by the selfsame sky, vaunt in their youthful sap, at height decrease, and wear their brave state out of memory, then the conceit of this inconstant stay sets you most rich in youth before my sight, where wasteful time debateth with decay, to change your day of youth to sullied night. And all in war with time for love of you, as he takes from you, I and graft you knew. Threw a curve at you, didn't he? Mm-hmm. Well, let's see what he says in 16. But wherefore do not you a mightier way make war upon this bloody tyrant time, and fortify yourself in your decay with means more blessed than my barren rhyme? Now stand you on top of happy hours, and many maiden gardens yet unset with virtuous wish would bear your living flowers, much liker than your painted counterfeit. So should the lines of life that life repair, which this time's pencil or my pupil pen, neither in inward worth nor outward fair, can make you live yourself in eyes of men, to give away yourself keeps yourself still, and you must live drawn by your own sweet will. You aren't. Who will believe my verse in time to come if it were filled with your most high deserts? Nor yet, heaven knows, it is but as a tomb which hides your life and shows not half your parts. If I could write the beauty of your eyes and in fresh numbers number all your graces, the age to come would say, this poet lies. Such heavenly touches ne'er touched earthly faces. So should my papers, yellowed with their age, be scorned like old men of less truth than tongue, and your true rights be termed a poet's rage and stretched meter of an antique song. But were some child of yours alive that time, you should live twice, in it and in my rhyme. You're nodding with a smiling of knowledge.
No, I...
Yes, you are.
Yeah, that child of time that's alive, so you live twice. You live through your child, he's saying. So I think it's the time passing on, but it's not gone. There's something else going on.
He seems quite taken up with aging. And, yes. You know,
the changes.
And time. The tyrant time. Mm-hmm.
What are the two means that would perpetuate, sustain the life of the person to whom he addresses his sonnets?
Having a child.
I beg your pardon?
Having a child.
And what's the other one?
Something written.
If what? Something written down.
Something.
What would that be?
Just write a
sonnet. Something that will last. Yeah.
Is that right? Do you buy that? Pete says the second means that would immortalize this person that Shakespeare is addressing would be Shakespeare's own sonnets.
Yes.
Is that what he's saying?
Poetry and other things. Things that live beyond your time, go down in history, or, you know, like his sonnets.
Is Shakespeare actually writing that in his sonnets, saying that there are two ways that you could be sustained forever, one by having a child and another by my sonnets?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, provided that he's writing about that person. That's the impression I get, if he's writing about that person.
Aaron?
I have a question. During the time that Shakespeare wrote this, was this something that, for the people of that time, that was easily, they could read it very easily? Or did it have to be decoded?
Are you asking me that because I said I was alive to hear you?
I don't know.
That's a good question.
Oh, language.
We'll discuss that at dinner, okay? Right now we've got a solvent problem here. They had their own headaches back then. Number 18. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. That should be T-O-O, not T-O. Has all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance of nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe, or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. What's the this?
It's not a poet. I mean the poem.
Devouring time, blunt thou the lion's paws, and make the earth devour her own sweet brood. Pluck the keen teeth from the fierce tiger's jaws, and burn the long-lived phoenix in her blood. Make glad and sorry seasons as thou fleetest, and do whate'er thou wilt, swift-footed time, to the wide, wide world and all her fading sweets, but I forbid thee one most heinous crime. Oh, carve not with thy brow hours my love's fair brow, nor draw no lines there with thine antique pen. Him in thy course untainted do allow, for beauty's pattern to succeeding men. Yet do thy worst, O time, despite thy wrong. My love shall live in my verse ever live young. My love shall in my verse ever live young. Are you growing more confident in what you were? Well, that's some. Look at 55. It's an often anthologized sonnet.
55?
55. 55, yes.
Oh, I don't like that. 55?
Mm-hmm.
It looks like 30, is this 55? Right there. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm looking for page 55.
Okay.
Not marveled are the gilded monuments of princes, shall outlive this powerful rhyme. But you shall shine more bright in these contents than unswept stone be smeared with sluggish time. When wasteful war shall statues overturn, and broils root out the work of masonry, nor Mars his sword, nor war's quick fire shall burn the living record of your memory. Against death and all oblivious enmity shall you pace forth. Your praise shall still find room, even in the eyes of all posterity that wears this world out to the ending doom. So, till the judgment that yourself arise, you live in this and dwell in lovers' eyes. Mm-hmm. Is that a safe boast that Shakespeare makes?
Only if people read the sonnet. If nobody read the sonnet after he wrote it, then this person that he's writing to will never live again.
My question isn't would that person, but is the boast safe?
No.
Why? No? It's not. Why not? How could Shakespeare ever be, you were wrong?
Well, for the reason...
In this one.
For the reason that he suggests that kind of immortality is never a safe boast.
You all agree with that? That the sonnet could disappear, and then it would have been a weak boast, a false boast, an unmeetable boast.
Well, people that knew about what he was writing about would probably have it in their memories. They dwell in others' eyes.
Well, I'm going to give an answer for a change, may I? I say the boast is absolutely safe, 100%. He can never be faulted. Why? Because if the sonnet survives, it has survived, huh? If the sonnet does not survive, we've not got what?
The boast.
The boast. Nobody will know he said it, right?
Yeah. Okay.
All right?
Okay.
It's kind of twisted logic, but...
He played it safe.
I'll grant you that.
That's true.
Tricky guy. Okay, let's move on to the last page. And seven on one of these is 422, and I'm getting eager for you to get together and concentrate on one. These four are by many people, well, by one, by Roman, considered to be as good as any he's got. I really like them. 73, let's look at that one. That time of year thou layest in needy hold, when yellow leaves are none or few to hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold. Bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long. We won't discuss that one, but you might someday want to have an interesting discussion and simply ask somebody, what is the antecedent of this in the first line of the couplet there at the end? This thou perceivest. What is it that the listener, the person to whom he addresses himself, perceives? Number 116. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with remover to remove. Oh no. It is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempest and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickle's compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error, and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved. That one you might have come across somewhere. Number 129. The expense of spirit, the waste of shame, is lust in action. Until action, lust is perjured, murderous, bloody, full of blame, savage, extreme, rude, cruel, not to trust, enjoy no sooner but despise it straight, past reason hunted and no sooner had. Past reason hated as a swallowed bait, on purpose laid to make the taker mad. Man in pursuit and in possession so, had having an inquest to have, extreme, a bliss in proof, and proved a very woe. Before, a joy proposed, behind, a dream. All this the world well knows, yet none knows well to shun the heaven that leads men to this hell. 146. Poor soul, the center of my sinful earth, thrall to these rebel powers at the array, why dost thou pine within and suffer dirt, painting that outward wall so costly gay? Why so large cost, having so short a lease, dost thou upon thy fading mansion spend? Shall worms, inheritors of this success, eat up thy charge? Is this thy body's end? Then, soul, live thou upon thy servant's loss, and let that pine to aggravate thy store. Buy terms divine in selling hours of dross, within be fed, without be rich no more. So shall thou feed on death, that feeds on men, and death once dead, there's no more dying then. Okay, let's do 149. Thank you for agreeing with me. I'll give you my question right now. Do you agree with Shakespeare? It's an evaluative question. Is Shakespeare right? Do you agree with him in that sonnet? So if you would reorganize into groups of three or four and hack away at the sonnet, then we'll get together in about 20 minutes or less. Okay? And see what we do.
Okay.
So make nice little circle pockets there so that. How about two more groups of three? And husband and wife don't work together, okay? Because there could be too much.
You might want a
big partner? Brother and sister, okay? Brother and sister.
I don't know if we're trying to say this it's right or wrong. I say that, maybe not to have this feeling for even at that moment is right. I mean, it could be all these things at that moment would not have to last for days and days.
What doesn't last, Aaron?
The lust or these feelings of. I don't know. What is the question?
Where do you see he says that lust lasts for many days?
Just saying, there's the object that you're lusting for, and however much time up to that object, and then once it's proved after that, it's not so much a time thing, I guess, but.
Yeah, no, I didn't see it as a time thing either, but it sounds like he's saying that it's, you want something so badly that you're beyond reason, and then afterwards, once you've indulged in whatever the lust was, that then you hate it, and that this whole thing was laid as a bait to, to make you mad to begin with, and that, once you've had it, then it's not that great anyway, and it's only a dream afterwards, and yet everyone knows this, but no one's smart enough to avoid it. That's the impression I get he's talking about here. But, when you can want something so badly, we were talking about when I first came out here, there's not much chocolate around, and I love chocolate, and I wanted my homemade chocolate chip cookies so bad when we first got out here. But if I had had some, then afterwards it wouldn't have been that great anyway. So.
We
kind of
thought it was like, if you lost, it's almost a biblical thing that thou shalt not covet, and having sought material goods all your life, you finally get them and it isn't enough, and that is a hell, or it shuns heaven.
David in the small group was wondering, this is David over here, was wondering if Shakespeare very carefully and deliberately used the masculine pronoun if he was speaking only of the male part of the race. Did you have a thought on that? How did you think he meant all humans or just
men? Oh, yeah. All humans. Generic men, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We thought maybe he was talking about himself.
Yeah.
That maybe he'd had an encounter with a prostitute or something
And my first thought was this was sex. But then we discussed it, and this could be lust for any...
Chocolate chip.
Anything. Maybe like a king could lust for some land next door, and he sent his armies and murders bloody, full of blame. And then after he got this next kingdom or whatever, why then he thought of all the horror that he had, and the boys that had died, and it was hell to him. The land that he got wasn't worth the tragedy that he caused. It was just his lust that caused this.
What's your name?
Christy.
Christy, tell us why you don't agree with him.
Well, I took it to be the pursuit of love. And in Shakespeare's plays, the two loving characters, the courting is never an easy path. So that's why I thought that way with some of his adjectives. And I think to pursue something, even if later you regret, you always gain some sort of experience from that. And that you can't live your life saying, well, I'm not going to pursue this because I'll regret it later, or I'm not going to do this because I'll feel bad afterwards, or that person might not like me, or this might not be as good. I think I can't live my life like that. So that's why I disagree.
I like that. If you change lust to passion, because I think that's how it starts out, that's really the stuff of life. And lust is where it can go to an extreme, and then his argument follows. But the passion, I think he's talking about himself in the sense that every artist is on the edge of the kind of madness that he talks, because artists are passionate by nature. They lust after truth and beauty and all kinds of things.
I mean, I thought I mentioned Michelangelo and put his great work for him. He certainly had a passion for life. I guess that's a lust, but he, you know, did a lot of great. And
doesn't that mean a lot?
For that lust.
Go ahead.
Well, if you change it to passion instead of lust, but they aren't the same thing.
No, I don't think so.
I wouldn't think it was the same.
Bert Holmes just said boldly, do it so shamefully that you're really forthright about it.
Yeah, and passion. And you always risk.
Yeah, it's just right out there. It's beyond shame, unabashed or something.
Yeah.
Is that the same thing?
Yes, yeah, some of that, that you just follow whatever it is that drives you, and the risk is that it can become what he's talking about, and that's obviously bad, and the way he sets up the argument, it's hard to dispute what he says, but that's the risk, I think.
I'll ask you about a specific one, avarice. You think that everyone who lusts for money, wealth, comes to the pain that the sonnet predicts?
No, you wouldn't necessarily go and steal.
I beg your pardon?
You wouldn't necessarily steal, even if you wanted money, you probably wouldn't go out and steal it. Avarice, greed.
I didn't understand that. What did you
say? You asked about avarice?
Yes, the avaricious person.
Greed?
Yeah, let's just say money.
Yeah, money.
And wealth of some kind, material wealth.
And want it badly, you don't necessarily go out and steal it.
So what are you saying? That there can be an avaricious person who does not suffer from his lust?
Well, he doesn't act upon it.
He doesn't act on it.
Well, let's say he does. Is everyone who pursues material wealth to the extreme, to the point, the extent where you would call it lust, do you say that he suffers the degree to which Shakespeare's is here?
Maybe we should ask Donald Trump. Huh?
Well, can I tell you, if he gives up everything just to get money,
yeah, mm-hmm,
I think he's going to be unhappy.
Eventually, maybe not. I mean, it may take some time, you know, a few years or
But eventually it
comes. Sooner or later, every avaricious person is going to come to this
point. Well, not every single one, but we're talking about the majority.
I have there with the second last line and the third last word. Mm-hmm. None. Pete, why are you looking at us in that tone of voice?
Well, but maybe that's a general term. Yeah, none, no, I mean, he was just using words to fill it, finish this.
I think there are people who are greedy to the point of lust who don't suffer the consequences.
You think they do?
They don't.
Or they do or don't
suffer the whole consequences. Of
that would fall to sonnet then, wouldn't it? You said the sonnet is fall
because.
Yeah. Well,
here, go ahead.
No, I see that I think a lot of people, there are probably many people who will die very wealthy and be very greedy, and they'll just die happy because that's just what they wanted in life. But I think, I don't get that out of here though. I see it more like this man did in the term of passionate about other things, not so much like money and material things, but about perfection and beauty and lusting, like in an artist way, and that so many artists then eventually kill themselves. I mean, you know.
Do you think Shakespeare is limiting his sonnet to that kind of person?
I don't know. Maybe, but maybe not.
That's a good answer.
Well, if he's lusting to the point where he ends up killing himself, I mean, that he must have been in hell. I mean, he must have gone through a hell, so this proves him right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I agree with it. I think it's right.
I think what I get from that word none, I think he's accurate by using that word because it says to me that we're all vulnerable. We're all vulnerable to whatever our lust or whatever our heaven is.
And do we succumb to that vulnerability?
Sure.
We do.
We all do. Mm-hmm.
So is he saying that this happens to everybody once? Is that what he's saying? Everybody at one time or other is a victim of lust, mm-hmm. realized?
I think that's what I... Mm-hmm.
Could I say that I heard it said that there aren't too many people who go to their grave saying, gee, I wish I could take my money with me. I could live a little longer so I could have more money.
You think there aren't very many who do that?
I think they're more likely to regret that they don't have more time with their children or whatever.
I don't think this is as much, now that we've talked about it, I don't think this has much to do with money.
Well, I didn't say it did. I just took one. I took a rather
material goods.
Common interest we have. One
because this is it says enjoyed no sooner, but despised straight. So to me, this is a short-term thing. It's
straight.
You have it now, and right away it's gone. I mean, it's a short span of time that he's talking about.
Something you do that you regret in the very act.
Yeah, or soon after. Like, and then he talks about this dream, you know, before, a joy before. You know, you think about it, you're so happy about it, and then it's like a dream, it's gone. You wonder what it was all about.
Are there many lusts that fit that category? I don't remember.
Sure.
Jim, are there many lusts that fit that category?
Well, I don't know.
I think there are lots of
them.
You haven't
know.
Been having any fun on Earth, have
you?
If I'm on a diet, you know, like this piece of cake I lust after, and I eat it, and I no more than swallow the last piece, and I regret every minute of it. I mean, that's an example, right? I mean, if you're no more than through with it, I mean, I'm sure all you women have felt this, and you just a
minute. You're more upset about a piece of cake than I do then.
You're on a diet, you know.
You suggested food. He said drink could be another.
Oh, well, no.
Is sex one of those? Is that one where there's likely to be a very quick response to realize the futility of it or the shame of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the only one where, you know, all the terrible descriptions he gives to it. No, poor Wayne, savage, extreme. I mean, getting drunk doesn't necessarily, or eating a cake isn't savage, extreme, and rude, cruel. I mean, are you speaking from experience? No, I'm just great about the bigger boy. And I wonder if Shakespeare isn't speaking from experience. You know, when he talks about this swallowed bait, you know, a fish takes a bait, and then, you know, as soon as he's hooked, hey, he said, I shouldn't eat that worm. I'm purpose laid to make the taker mad, you know. Was there some woman that, you know, tempted him? Yeah. And then he took the bait and then he said,
yeah, I did that. Freud would love you.
Go ahead.
I was going to say the last word I'll ever eat.
I think he's right.
We get a new
version. Getting it.
My impression is that it's always...
Your what? Your impression?
My impression is that it's going to morality. And although we all have a different sense of morals, the lust is if you go after something that's against your own morality, and then you feel all the regret and all those negative things leading to the hell. So if it has to do with sex and it's something that you lust, I mean, that's always lust there, but you've always been taught is wrong. But you left after it, then you sort of regret it afterwards. Or if you go for anything that you morally feel to be wrong that you left after.
Is he saying something's wrong? Is he saying that is wrong? Is he speaking as a moralist here, as an ethicist, or is he? Pete says no.
No, he calls it heaven. He calls it a bliss, improvement, and joy proposed. I don't think he thinks it's all bad. Well,
there's a good side too.
Right. And it's when you actually go after the bad side that you have the regret.
What's the hell piece of the last line?
After it's happened, or the knowledge of what you've done?
Or the disappointment in that it wasn't as fulfilling as you think it was. You know, as you, it's exciting now, it's over. Now what?
I asked about the word because it's related to this question of moral. You say he is not pointing to this effect of satisfied lust as being a moral awareness that the person had. And my question is, why does he use the word hell then if he isn't trying to give it a moral dimension since you don't see?
Oh, I do agree that he's giving it a moral dimension.
He is. Yeah. Do you all agree with that? That's what he's saying?
I think he's more of a psychologist than that, just maybe I'm projecting it. He talks about the inner suffering we cause ourselves by our inability to just enjoy what we enjoy.
Explain the difference between what might be a psychological pain and a moral, as you see it.
I'm not sure that I could distinguish it. I mean, I think it's a conflict with morality. I sort of agree with that point.
Does an amoral person suffer morally? Go ahead.
No, I just think amoral, no. They wouldn't have a set of morals at all. They probably wouldn't.
Does an amoral person suffer the effects of satisfied lust, as Shakespeare puts here?
Probably not.
I don't think so.
You think they do?
Not as Shakespeare puts it. I think if they get caught.
Yeah, but doesn't amoral mean does not have morals?
That's what I mean. That's what I mean. That unless he gets caught.
But you still suffer the hurts of the regret or the brokenness of what happened.
The amoral.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what Jim means by a psychological pain. I don't know. Is that?
You're not hurting because you know you did something wrong. You're just hurting because.
I'm trying to understand the waste of shame phrase. The expense of spirit is a waste of shame. Like somebody's bothering to feel shame. as if it's a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like a, an indulgence in self-torture. I don't know that that's moral. I just think maybe somebody's feeling a pseudo-moral conflict, not a true moral conflict.
Well, the reference to waste, though, is spirit, isn't it?
I didn't hear you.
It's spirit. The expense of spirit, this rich source we have of spirit, is wasted.
It's a pseudo-morality, which is wasting spirit, because you touch the true spirit, true morality. Is that an argument?
Well, if you reverse that sentence and you know what the subject is, maybe it makes a little more sense. Lust in action is the expense of spirit and a waste of shame. That's what I understand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because you acted it out, or because you followed through
with them.
But
shame can be a pathway to healing.
Say that again.
Shame can be a pathway to healing if it's an honest encounter with self. But if it's indulged and we don't really get to the bottom of yourself, then it's a pseudo kind of process. It's an indulgence in self-torture.
That's what we would say, but I don't know that he goes that far. You know, I mean, we would say that, you know, about shame, but I don't know if he's going quite that far.
What bothers me most about it is the phrase, on purpose laid, which is to say God is finally at fault. God made it that way. And we suffer as a result.
Why do you think he's blaming that on God, though?
On purpose laid. Who else had the purpose?
Oh, another person.
The person.
He was tempted.
For every lust?
Or could it be Satan?
There is another person
who
had
a
purpose.
Or could it be Satan? I mean, he doesn't really say who's laying the bait.
No, but it has more of a cosmic dimension to me than just another person, or it somehow is laid out that way in the order of things.
Swallowed bait is cosmic?
No.
that there's bait out there that sucks you into the lust hole has a cosmic dimension. The world was made that way to suck you in, to set you up.
Well,
I, as he said, something about time. Stand still. It's time to quit. And I'm glad we got this resolved.
We should have another vote.
Let's try to vote. How many to now say yes? You do agree with him that he is right. You say I know. How many are less certain? Okay. How many say absolutely no? You do not agree that he's wrong. Okay. Thank you. We can leave him in a circle. We'll do good for the next 2 years in a circle.
Communities of garbage. They say so much. I'm torn in this day of the day.
I can never put it into words, just the feelings of the are just amazing, just mind-blowing.
That's why we should just leave them the way they are, you know, and we harm them by trying to put them into some other language.
Can you try, T.S. Eliot, you try and dissect the creation and destroy it?
Yeah.
But
that was, I enjoyed that a lot. That was good to listen to. Really. Thank you very much.
A discussion we would never have had when I was in high school.
Say that again.
A discussion we would never have had when I was in high school.
Mine either.
Yeah, because two of those I'd memorized when I was in high school.
Number 116?
No.
No. Oh, and the earlier ones here.
Yeah.
What are those? 55?
No.
No. What's on the other sheet then? That's 70.
This time I'm here, and that was more. Right. Oh, and then the one that was over here.
Oh. Okay.
And I almost remember. Do you make your students memorize?
No.
See, we had a memorize.
A number that do.
We had a memorize so much when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. We would never have gotten an A if you had at least 200 lines of poetry.
Wow. All my students would have flunked.
We have A, but you know I can still remember.
That's a good feeling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
I couldn't memorize it that fast today, I'll tell you.
I never required it, but a number of my students memorize things, and today if I meet them, they'll address me by reciting line. Maybe not the whole piece, but it's so interesting that some of those things have stuck with them.
Oh, I could